Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Let's talk. Let's talk.
John Brown.
Let's talk.
Going to be speaking to Roger Lewis about the life and death of Peter Sellers after a blast of this. That one down. You will recognize that as, of course, the theme from the Pink Panther film. And my next guest is talking all about the life and death of Peter Sellers, who was, of course, as will be forever associated with this. It's a fascinating look. Tragic and instructive story, delighted to say that I'm joined by Roger Lewis himself. Roger, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Many of us think, of course, about Peter Sellers as Clouseau in the Pink Panther themes, but there is so much, but there is so much more to Sellers than that, and so much more in the intelligence, but also the madness that goes along with the genius.
Yes, that's the thing with Sellers. The madness and the genius were intertwined, the light and the darkness, if you like. But yes, what a career he had. He felt a bit trapped by Inspector Clouseau and having to make all those Pink Panther films. He'd like to have done other things, more serious roles. But nevertheless, there he was going right back to the Goon Show on the radio in the early 50s and just after the war. Big star in Britain, making all those wonderful little black and white films with the Bolting Brothers, I'm All Right, Jack, oh. Two-Way Stretch, Wrong Arm of the Law, all these sort of wonderful little comedies. Then he gets together with Stanley Kubrick and does Dr. Strangelove, which is one of the great masterpieces of cinema. Then he meets Blake Edwards and starts doing the Pink Panthers and became a big world star with Sophia Loren in The Millionaire's and so on. A great career, fabulous career, and dead at 54, which is no age at all.
Yeah, indeed. You just mentioned I'm All Right, Jack, and I just forgot one of my favourite lines about when he plays the trade union leader, isn't he? And that he's saying, you know, Soviet Russia, because you've got all those fields of corn and then the ballet in the evening.
Yes, he's very wistful about the Soviet Union. He's never been, obviously, but he just imagines that, yes, all them cornfields and the ballet every evening. He sort of, Sellers was such a genius, he could give a line like that, a sort of poignancy, poetry.
Yeah.
As well as the fact that this man, Fred Kite, you know, is a complete idiot.
Where does he come from, Sellers? Because, I mean, a lot of us won't, because, I mean, we'll know him from sort of the Goon Show and the inspired madness with sort of Seacombe and Spike Milligan. Yeah. But what's his background? How does he first come to prominence, as it were?
Well, yeah, his background really was in music hall and vaudeville. His parents were little entertainers at the end of the pier, travelling around England when he was a child, you know, in the 30s, playing all these little theatres, these little tiny venues. And he grew up with a great fondness, I think, for that sort of rather dusty, ghostly music hall world. He was always playing those sorts of characters later on. Now, that was how he started, and then off he went into the World War II. He was in the Air Force, and he was in Burma. And when he came back, he was part of Ralph Reeder's gang shows and entertaining the troops and all that kind of thing. And that's what got him into radio initially. And he made his way up from the very bottom to the very top.
And he makes the move from, if you like, doing the radio into the black and white, into those sort of early movies almost seamlessly, in a way that perhaps Spike Milligan or Harry Secombe didn't.
That's right. I remember when I interviewed Spike Milligan for my book, he said to me that one of the biggest surprises of his life was that Peter never asked me to work with him on a film. He never asked me to write him a script for a film. And that's because Sellers was very competitive. He wasn't really going to want rivals to his throne. And he would always be a bit like that, the great rivalry with Blake Edwards over who really was responsible for creating the character of Clouseau, because in a way Blake Edwards did, because he wrote the scripts and so on, but Sellers brought it all alive.
Yeah.
He was an only child, and I think he always remained a sort of egotistical only child.
I suppose one of the things you can say is that, you know, Spike has the sort of the comic madness and the battiness, if you like. Harry Secombe is very much goes back to that sort of comedic, chubby, happy chappy. But Sellers is much more detached. He's much more calculating, I think is the word I always use with Sellers. There is a fierce intelligence behind
there really
it.
Was.
Yeah.
There really was a calculation and a scrupulousness. There was a great story that Harry Secombe told about when they were doing the Goons. They'd just be lined up behind three microphones recording these shows for the radio. And yet Sellers would somehow physically transform into the different characters. So he'd shrink, or he'd grow, or he'd become sort of hunchbacked, or he'd become more strapping. He was just taken over by whatever role he was playing, and he would become these people. And that was what was so strange about his genius. It really was transformative. You'd get a lot of other actors that need all the makeup and the funny noses and the wigs and all the rest of it, but Sellers was transforming himself inside as well. He would psychologically become all these different people in all his films. So Dr. Strangelove, it's wonderful because he's playing lots of different characters in the same film.
You see, and the thing is, let's think about this for a minute, because if you go from, you know, the much-loved, you know, Man in the White Suit, those Ealing comedies from the 50s, there are very few, even today, and you've got Steve Coogan doing the full, which is, I think it's fascinating, because I would say that he is an intelligent comedian who can make the role between comedy, and really serious films like Philomena. And Sellers has gone from this goon show about this background to do something like Strangelove, and to play it again in a chilling way. He's not doing a Carry On film. He's not doing an Ealing comedy. He's doing a Kubrick, you know, a dark and scary Kubrick movie.
Yeah, he was a great actor. He was a serious comic actor. I think the person he most wanted to be like when he was younger, when he was starting out, the person he wanted to emulate was Alec Guinness, who obviously played lots of roles in the same film in Kind Hearts and Coronets, and they did work together in Lady Killers. And he always wanted that Alec Guinness-like ability to transform himself and be taken seriously as an actor, not just as a comic. And as you say, quite rightly, the only person that succeeds to the throne today is Steve Coogan, who can do serious, he can do silly, he can combine the two. And Alan Partridge is, started out as a sort of more of a just a comic satire of a ridiculous TV presenter. But it's become more poignant over time. Mm-hmm. There's more depth, there are more layers emerging as Coogan has become an actor rather than just a comedian.
And during the 60s, I mean, Sellers, you know, with his mini, marrying Britt Eklund, you know, living, he seems to have that sort of, almost a playboy, but he seems to have that 60s life. I mean, on the surface, it's all the glittering things, but again, there are, as you say in the book, there are some very sort of dark chapters in there, and obsession starts to come through as well.
Yes, he was fascinated with all the gadgetry he could now afford. I mean, the cameras and cars, changing cars all the time. And the great thing about Sellers, really, is that in the 60s, he was the 60s with the Britt Eklund marriage, his friendship with Tony Snowden and Princess Margaret. He was always photographed at premieres. He was staying at the Dorchester alongside Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. He became a big, swinging Sellers in the swinging 60s. And he was making these bright, colourful 60s films, which are now some wonderful period pieces, like Casino Royale or...
Party, for example.
The Party.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the colour, the look of the films, the hairstyles, the clothes. It's just totally 60s, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Austin Powers, if you think Austin Powers is good, you should check out Casino Royale, but I would only say you watch Casino Royale in 10-minute chunks, because it might have been very psychedelic at the time, but it's a bit of a hard watch in one sitting now, Roger, do you think?
Yes, it is a bit difficult to watch, because Sellers walked out and they had to piece it together from footage shot all over the place by lots of different directors. But you can see a huge amount of money on the screen, yeah. All those costumes and all the sets and everything. I mean, Woody Allen was involved writing scripts for it, and just about everyone in the British film industry was involved one way or another. They had sets going up in all the different studios. I mean, a wonderful kind of waste of money, really, but very 60s. And Sellers as well as that. He was at the heart of that. And yet, paradoxically, 1964, I think it was, he had his heart attack, and that was nearly the end of him. He nearly died.
Yeah, I mean, the health issues are going to come through. And you think of all that madcap manic energy, you know, and sort of that he brought to his roles. But, the warning signs were there.
Yes, exactly. He was quite frail, actually, as far as his health went, with the collapse when he was making a film with Billy Wilder called Kiss Me Stupid, and he had to be replaced by another actor. He wasn't able to carry on making that film. And then he came back with What's New Pussycat, which is with Peter O'Toole, and he played a role that was written by Woody Allen, and he played a role that was originally written for Groucho Marx as a sort of mad, sex-obsessed psychiatrist.
Talking about sort of famous co-stars, I mean, Sophia Loren, and I mean, I don't think we can possibly play Goodness Gracious Me now because of the age in which we live. But was there an obsessive character thing aspect to his relationship with Sophia Loren as well? Because she is one of the beauties of the 60s, / 50s, / 70s.
Well, I'm still with us, of
yes,
course.
Indeed.
But the Millionaireess. Now, that film was Sellers' first big international success. It could not be made today because, of course, he blacks up to play this Indian doctor, and he does the Goodness Gracious Me and all this kind of thing that would now seem racist, I suppose, in our very sensitive age. But nevertheless, back then it made him a big star. And his character, there was this little Indian doctor having this love affair with Sophia Loren. Sellers fell in love with Sophia Loren because his character did. He did. And he left his wife and his children and moved into a bachelor apartment in central London where he thought he could sort of seduce Sophia Loren. And it was Wolf Mankiewicz who worked on the script for that who told me this was the first sign that Sellers' eccentricity was tipping over into real madness.
And is this, is this an obsessive thing? Is he what we'd... I mean, today we'd call stalking, wouldn't we? I mean, I suppose so.
It was an obsessive love he had. Well, I don't think it was love. It was just an obsession. Mm. And when the film was finished, he'd follow her around Europe to different film locations, and it made a bit of a nuisance of himself, really. And it was the one thing that when someone was writing her biography years later, she didn't really want any mention of Peter Sellers in the book. She found it very distasteful, his strange, clammy obsession that he had with her.
How did she deal with it then? Did she just tell him to sort of, or did she have a word with some Italian male friends, if you like, and tell him to go forth?
I think Carlo Ponti had connections with.
Interesting characters, perhaps.
Italian strongmen, yes, and I think that he sent some of these people to guard her. Actually, sort of sit outside the hotel room, then sit outside the bedroom. You know, make sure Sellers didn't get in. So he made an idiot of himself overall.
So just
all of that, and then. You know, in that way that people have these terrible mad obsessions. The next thing, it's gone. They can't even remember that they felt that way. And Britt Eklund became the next big obsession. You know, he met her and married her sort of inside 10 days, I think. And then that all went wrong pretty quickly.
And so then, when does the move to? I mean, does the Pink Panther starts? I mean, it's originally because Niven's in it originally, isn't it? And that's like the late, is it 68, 69?
David Niven was the star,
yeah.
And they never expected this sort of minor role of the funny French detective to take over the movie. It was going to be Peter Ustinov, I think, and he dropped out for some reason, and Sellers took over it quite late in the day. And it was such a success, they instantly set up A Shot in the Dark, which was the sequel. And then I think they did The Party after that. And then in the 70s, returned to Clouseau, which is when I was in my teens in the 70s. And that's when I first started becoming aware of Peter Sellers with all these films coming out, which I loved. And then I found out about The Goons, because The Goons was really my dad's generation. So I got all these old LPs and listened to that. And it became my obsession then, this wonderful protean actor. I loved it.
Yeah, and does he move to LA and then does he go to the West Coast thing then and becomes part of that,
yes,
sort of British colony in Los Angeles situation?
Yeah, he was one of those. Yes, he was there. He made The Party out there, and so he became part of that world along with people like, you know, Michael Caine and all these movie star exiles. But he was always coming back and forth to Britain, and then he'd always stay at the Dorchester Hotel, which, yeah, sadly, is where he died.
One of the towards the sort of late 70s, where is he going? Because I mean, being there when he plays Chance the Butler is obviously seen as a classic. It's a very sort of reflective film. Very, you know, you wouldn't expect that from you know, if you're used to Clouseau, you wouldn't expect him to play Chance. So towards the sort of 70s turn into the 80s, how do you think he was coping, as it were?
Well, he died in 1980, so mid-ish, late 70s were when he was fading away, yeah, with increasing cardiovascular trouble. He made Being There, as you say, it's a strange, haunting film. He's plays this blank person,
yeah,
who maybe that was the real Peter Sellers underneath all the performing and all the jokes and all the silliness. This rather spiritual, empty space was the real Peter Sellers. Anyway, he managed to create this character of Chance the Gardener in Being There, which is just a great film. I mean, it's just a film of rare beauty, I think. But that wasn't the final thing he did.
Okay.
Curse of Fu Manchu, and that came out after he died, in fact. A lot of trouble making that because he was ill and he was difficult and he was firing the director and getting the script rewritten. I mean, it was a huge sort of mess, really. But again, because Sellers had made such a lot of money for Hollywood, through Clouseau, he was allowed to get away with all of this, all the reshoots and the re-editing and goodness knows what. And it's, again, amazingly well designed film. All the sets and the scenery, they were all designed by a man called Alexander Trauner, who worked with Orson Welles and Billy Wilder. So visually, it's incredible. And it's quite a goonish sort of script and concept. And he was filling the film with his old friends, people like Jean Le Mesurier and all these people that he worked with in his early days. So it's a profoundly nostalgic film, actually. And very goonish. And I think underrated, strangely.
Goonish and underrated. Personally, I mean, he has four wives. Obviously, people remember British excellent practices in the 60s things, but presumably he wasn't an easy person to be married to put it mildly.
Oh, I think he must have been a terrible person to try to be married to him. Because whenever he was playing a role, he'd become that person for the duration of the film. So he made a film called Only Two Can Play, in which he plays a Welsh librarian. And his wife at the time, his first wife, she said, you know, for 2 months I was living with a Welsh librarian. And the person he was living with his sort of assistant, really, because everyone had abandoned him, or he'd abandoned them. He was living with this assistant called Michael Jeffrey throughout the shoot of Being There. And he said he was just Chance the Gardener all the time. And then the day the film wrapped, that character was gone and he was someone else again. So it's very strange. In fact, it's almost not like being an actor. It's not like acting at all. It's being rather than performing.
And we talk about immersive, don't we? We talk about method, and perhaps that was Sellers' way of, because he had his own peculiar take on how to approach a role.
Well, he was terrified from day to day the comic genius wouldn't come back and that he couldn't do it. It would have gone. He had no control over his gift. He didn't know whether he could be funny or not. That's why Kubrick trained about 8 cameras on him simultaneously just to capture everything at once, because he hated rehearsal. He didn't like to use up his energy rehearsing and preparing. He'd just do it. He didn't like to have lots of takes because the comic gift would evaporate. I mean, Laurence Olivier could do 20 takes and he'd be the same every time.
Yeah.
The Sellers would just do it all so differently.
I'm also thinking for the younger listeners as well. I mean, that's almost like Robin Williams, wasn't it? Because he has the same manic energy, but the same, if you've seen Insomnia, where he plays a straight role, you know, against killer, against Al Pacino's detective. I mean, again, he's quite frighteningly intense in that one as well. And again, he has the highs and the lows.
Yes, exactly. And Robin Williams, he was always very open about the fact that Peter Sellers was his great inspiration. He wanted to be Peter Sellers with all the funny voices and all the quick thinking and the sort of improvisation. And then he's another one who self-destructed. Also another comedian who yearned to do serious roles. And as you say, he did, and he was very convincing as a psychopath.
Indeed. So when it comes to writing something about Sellers, because I suppose everybody thinks they know him, because we have this relationship, you know, and if you are, you know, we're the same sort of age and we grew up with Sellers as Clouseau and then perhaps as, you know, the Goon Show, Ying Tong Did Lipo, etc. But there is more, you know, and then we may look at that 60s stuff. We may look at things like, you know, the part Birdie Num Num with the party and the over, you know, psychedelic overload that is Casino Royale. And then there is this, you know, not to go complete cool full Conrad on you, but there is this heart of darkness that lies within Sellers.
There is. And he found that increasingly hard to conceal, or should we say he found it easier to yield to it when he was rich and famous, because no one would say no to him. He was much more tractable and professional early on. When he was making his way. And once he'd made it, he was impossible, really. The way he changed his cars all the time and changed his wives all the time and his girlfriends all the time. He was had a very sort of short attention span, very bored very easily, I think, and depressed. I think today people would probably give him all kinds of psychiatric labels, you know, like, oh, he was autistic, he was bipolar, he was on the spectrum. But those categories, those words, those notions, they weren't around even when I was writing my book. So you end up just saying, well, he was mad. But it was mad, crazy behavior. I mean, Spike Milligan was open about his psychiatric problems and his manic depression. Sellers never confessed to anything like that. He was just as he was from day to day. Well, not even day to day. It was from hour to hour. I mean, his children had a very difficult time because he could be all loving and lovely and jolly, and then he could suddenly get nasty for no reason.
What do you think? What do you think that people? Or what do you think his legacy is then? I mean, one of the. I mean, there's never been. I mean, Williams aside, there's never really been somebody who combines that energy with the madness, with the intelligence.
No, there's not. He's unique. He really is. Yes, we got Steve Coogan now. We had Robin Williams, but really, I think that Peter Sellers, he's up there in the sound era, as Chaplin was in the Buster Keaton in the silent era. I think the only people you can really compare Peter Sellers with are the likes of Laurence Olivier or Alec Guinness. Those great masters of the theatrical craft.
The book is called The Life and Death of Peter Sellers. It's by Roger Lewis, who brings you today. Roger, if people want to find you online, do you have an internet presence? Is there a website, or are you on
one of the social? God, no. No, I have never sent or received a text in my entire life. That book you have there, written by hand.
We salute you, Roger, but my listeners will be able to go to the Talk Radio Europe website and they can order it via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called The Life and Death of Peter Sellers. Roger, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Well, thanks ever so much for having me.